Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
Let's hit it.
There we go.
Hey, everybody. I'm Amy Scott. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where none of us is as smart as all of us.
I'm Kyle Rosendahl. It's Tuesday. We are doing a deep dive, the weekly deep dive into a single topic. Today, it's something called build to rent, being used to describe one of the biggest trends, the hottest trends in the housing market, where we're going to tell you what it means. We're not going to spoil the surprise. We're just going to keep you waiting around for it.
Yeah, okay. I'm going to spoil it right now.
Oh, all right.
A growing number of homes are being built exclusively as rentals. And these are single family homes built not to buy, but to rent out. Billions of dollars are flooding into this industry. So we're going to look at what this means for the housing market, for home ownership, and also the ability for folks to build wealth through housing in this country.
Here to make us smart on this today is Dan Eskich. He's a senior research fellow at the Kem Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah. Thanks for coming on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So we gave you the thumbnail sketch, right, of what build to rent is. What does it mean out there sort of, you know, as you drive around suburbia today?
Yeah, well, you've noticed housing is kind of the topic of conversation right now in the country amongst everything else. And this asset class has been around for a while. If we just go back to the 70s, just single family rentals in general have represented about a third or a little over a third of the housing stock or the rental stock, excuse me. And built for rent really has really taken off the last 5 years. So half of all the built for rent communities, there's roughly about 700, somewhere between 650 to 700 of them, depends how you categorize them. But half of those have come online the last 5 years. So, and they're heavily concentrated sort of in the Southeast and Southwest, the Phoenix, the Atlantas, that sort of corridor. And we're seeing roughly about currently the last 2 or 3 years, we have over $50 billion of money pouring into it, over 70 plus different partnerships between institutional investors, builders, REITs coming into the space. And they have a lot of different strategies. A lot of them are going to the build for rent space, but some of them are also acquiring existing single family homes.
Right, because this whole thing started really with investors buying up existing single family homes and renting them out after the housing crisis of the last decade, right? How did we get from there to here?
Right. It's really about stability and performance. If we looked at just returns in the residential category over the last 3 years, the last 5 years, single family rentals have outperformed apartments. If we looked at just overall all the other asset classes, really the only two in the last 3 years that have outperformed single family rentals have been industrial buildings and storage spaces. And so if you think about just building, right, it's really difficult and takes a lot of capital to build a large industrial facility or a portfolio of storage spaces. So single family rentals are a much easier entryway. And also the resistance recently, you know, with the not in my backyard attitude towards rental and apartment construction, that opposition to single family rentals aren't there. So it's much easier to get your entitlements, to get your permits, to convince the city to let you build. And so the entry point is really easier. And also stability, you know, over 43%, 43 to 45% of those who rent single family homes tend to stay there for 5 years or longer. So the turnover is much, much lower in single family rent. So it's about stability really when it comes down to it. It's especially in an inflationary period and an economic uncertainty, it's much safer to put your money into single family rentals at the moment.
Can I ask a really stupid question? You alluded in your first answer about communities, specific communities being built as build to rent. I understand that to mean that it's like there's a subdivision being built and everybody knows that these homes are not going to be sold. They're going to be rented out and that's what they're there for. And thank you very much. Is it that straightforward?
More or less, the attraction of it is they're kind of also built with the amenities of, say, a nice apartment complex. So you have a pool, maybe you have parks, trails. So in terms of, you know, a for sale single family, it's get in and get out and we're good to go. But in a built for rent community, it is more about having an amenity package of sort that is benefiting those renters.
So these projects are taking off at a time when there's this shortage of housing of any kind, really. But, you know, people who would like to be homeowners are saying there is harder to compete with investors paying cash. And I'm wondering if all these homes are getting built for rent to begin with, what does that mean for people who just, you know, want to get into the housing market and buy a home?
Yeah, I mean, it's really difficult to afford be a new first-time home buyer right now. And part of, I think, what the investors saw is we're in this great demographic patch where the largest share of first-time home buyers since the baby boom is between the 30 to 35-year-olds. Mm-hmm. We're having this wave of demand in literally every area of the country. It's not just exclusive to some metros. And so the demand for housing is just through the roof. And so having these single family rentals, they're just another competitor. But also, it's kind of a double-edged sword. They are bringing a much needed rental product that is very thin in most places. Single family rentals, you know, we often think about apartments. And, you know, if we look at just the share of single family owners, you know, 77% of single family owners have only 1 to 2 units in their portfolio. And so that brings up a whole sort of another competition. So the real place where it's hurting right now is on the land. So in the Southeast and Southwest, you know, these built for rent communities or partners are probably purchasing roughly about 1/4 to 1/3 of all the lots that they're going to build on. Hmm. So it is squeezing people out, but also they're just another competitor because we're so low on housing supply and we have a national housing shortage across the country that's why they're in this market because they see the opportunity. And so go ahead.
Yeah. So in your considered opinion then, and not opinion, I mean, you're a guy who knows his facts here. This adds to the housing supply and lets more people have adequate housing in this economy. Is that what I hear you saying?
Yeah, the situation is pretty difficult right now that any housing helps to alleviate prices. Yeah. But I agree with you on the wealth generation. You know, we are a nation of owners. We're not a renter nation. And so that does get to the question of wealth creation. And, you know, if you choose to rent, you probably have the means to build wealth in other ways. But the attractiveness of housing has always been you kind of build two birds with one stone. You are paying for your shelter, but you're also building wealth at the same time. And so that's the risk.
How much do we know about how much of this is people choosing to rent versus they have to rent because they can't afford to buy?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's about, on the single family front, it's about half of it is split, if I'm guessing. Again, it's very difficult to kind of break this down, but most often when we just look through a national survey, we see that people who choose to rent do it out of the ease of renting, the headaches of home ownership. I recently bought my first house and, you know, sometimes I wonder, should I just rent it? Yeah.
Congratulations or condolences. We've got a leak upstairs that I'm still trying to figure out. Yeah. So,
depends on the day. But so that's the attractiveness of it is you can still have that sort of family lifestyle and have kids and everything and not feel squeezed for space, especially in the suburban markets of the Atlantas, the Phoenixes, stuff, those areas like that. And so, but those who have no option but to rent, it's often because they don't qualify or they don't have enough for a down payment. And right now where we are in the housing financial situation for renters, you know, to qualify is very difficult with interest rates going up and so forth. That ability to become a homeowner has just been pushed further out ahead
Do you think this is a canary in the coal mine? Is probably a little strong, but do you think this is sort of a precursor of a more sharp decline in the home ownership rate in this economy? And it's been down since financial crisis. Do you think it's going to keep on going down?
I depends on the area. I hesitate to say yes, but my gut is telling me yes. Hmm. And I hate to feel that way, but it is because I think the home builders learned a valuable lesson in the last crisis as to not oversupply the market and just not allow any investor to buy. Those that allow investors, they vet their investors. So they have a vested interest to make sure that their communities, that their brands are seen as a stable participant in the economy, right? Yeah. And so from that perspective, I feel like we're no longer in an environment where we're just going to overbuild housing like we have in the 2000s.
Right.
What do you think this is going to mean for rent, which has been going up, you know, almost as rapidly as home prices? Is this adding to the rental supply, or because you're describing these as kind of amenity rich, you know, maybe higher income renters, is it not going to make a big difference?
I think it's adding to the rental supply, obviously, but because we are in such a strong housing demand demographic patch, we're just behind the curve because we underbuilt for the last 6 or 7 years after we kind of worked out all the housing oversupply from the last recession. So we're going to continue to see, especially with inflation, we're going to continue to see rents and housing prices go up. I think housing prices could be hitting a ceiling soon because of the rates. So I'm watching by the week just how existing for sale supply is coming online. That tells me just how much housing demand will sort of alleviate because of the rates. So, you know, not to say I'm a fan of the big rates, but I think we need the higher rates right now just to calm the house price growth. That will help on the rental side a little bit as well.
Who are the renters in a lot of these builder-owned communities, or is it tough to say? I'm thinking about the people who were traditionally squeezed out of homes in this economy, right? The lower end of the income spectrum, people of color, all the people we all know who can't sort of get ahead.
Yeah, typically when we break it out just by structure occupancy from the census data, you typically see associations with single family rentals. They tend to have a bit higher incomes than, say, those who are in an apartment and larger family size. So they could either have their mom or dad living with them, or grandparents, or they have kids. So the larger family size is typically those who occupy rentals. So that's why too, you know, in these suburban markets where we tend to have more job growth, more population growth, we're seeing an influx of single family rentals to target that market, family market, because they're finding that those families are having a hard time getting home ownership, getting the space. So that's why they see that opportunity to fill that void.
I guess just one last question is, I kind of don't know how I feel about this. And I'm thinking about a guy I met on a bus in Florida a couple months ago at the International Home Builders Show. And he's a builder, a traditional builder, but he said he was getting into the build to rent market, and he kind of felt bad about it. He was like, I don't think it's great for a society, but, you know, there's a lot of money there. And I'm wondering, I mean, what do you think? Is this good, bad, neutral?
I don't want to say the word neutral. I think it's both, and it depends where. I think it has the opportunity to get out of hand and for a lot of money to get in, and we could overbuild the market. But I also feel like right now, just given how expensive housing is, how millennials are behind the curve on home ownership, on the ability to start families, having that opportunity to rent something larger without paying, you know, $4,000 or $5,000, it is an opportunity to start families, right? Mm-hmm. So I think there's both a negative and a positive to it, you know. But I also see some resistance in some markets for those who are purchasing and renting homes. You know, they're forming HOAs and saying, we're not going to allow that here, or we're only going to allow, you know, X percent of our neighborhood to be purchased by investors and rented.
Right. There's a lot of pushback. Well, Dejan Eskich, thanks so much for sharing your research with us. He's at the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, I have to confess, that was a totally new one to me, the whole build-to-rent phenomenon. I knew nothing about it, and that's why it's awesome to have Amy Scott on this podcast, because she covers housing, and she knew it, and she was like, we ought to talk about this. So we did.
Yeah, and I've been wanting to look into this for a while. It's one of those stories I just haven't gotten to, so I'm so glad we got to dig in a little
bit. Me too. Let us know what you thought about the conversation. What do you think about build-to-rent? Did you know about it? Was it a new thing? Is it happening near you? Let us know. Let us know. Give us a call. Our number is 508-827-6278. 508-UB-SMART is how you do that in letter form. Or just a plain old voice memo at makemesmart@marketplace.org. We'll get it on the pod, and we'll be right back.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. The shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews, and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, time for the news fix, and Amy Scott, housing correspondent, goes with the housing news of the day, I believe.
Yeah, I'm going to stick with housing, and this is really good context for what we just talked about, which is home prices. So the S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller U.S. National Home Price Index, I know it's a mouthful.
It's all right.
It's hard to abbreviate. We're going to call it Case-Shiller from here on out, was up 19.8% in February from a year before. Basically 20% home price growth, which is even more than it was in January. And some of the cities, I mean, Phoenix up 33%, and it's been the fastest growing city price-wise for 33 straight months. Tampa really close behind. Miami prices were up 30%. I mean, every one of the 20 cities that they track in their 20-city index saw double-digit increases year over year.
Craziness.
So, yeah. Oh, and by the way, that 19.8% national increase was the third highest reading in the 35 years of this index. So this is pretty crazy. But that was February.
Yeah.
Right? There is a lag in this data. We did a whole explainer about why that is on Marketplace a few weeks ago, if you're interested in that story. But obviously, Kyle, lots happened since February. Mortgage rates have gone up sharply. I think I looked into this. It was about 3.75% at the end of February for a 30-year fix. That was the average. Now it's 5.11%. Yeah. So more than a point, full point higher. And there are signs the market is slowing down a little bit. New home sales fell last month, we just learned today. So did existing home sales for the second month in a row in March. And I think there's some good news at the bottom of this release, which is they say the macroeconomic environment is evolving rapidly and may not support extraordinary home price growth for much longer.
Which would be fundamentally a good thing. I mean, apologies to all you homeowners out there, of which I am one, but it's not real, man. That's the problem. It's just not
freaking
real. Yeah,
it's not. It's really not a good. This is not healthy.
Yeah.
We would all benefit from slower price growth.
All right. So I will blow quickly through mine. It is a tale of 8 letters, the first four of which are TWTR. That is, of course, the Twitter ticker symbol, which trades on the New York Stock Exchange, which today, as of this taping right now at 10:30 in the morning on Tuesday, is at $49.91. Why is that interesting? Well, because in short order, if you own a share of Twitter, you're going to get $54.20. And so I'm trying to figure out what the market is trying to tell us by pricing this stock now at $49.90. Do they not think Musk is going to go through with it? Do they think regulatory things are going to impede this? I can't quite figure out why the market is bewildered about this. So if you know, let me know, because that's an easy $5. Oh, and look at this. It's going down now as we speak, $49.88. it's an easy $5, right? You buy a share of Twitter today, you hang on to it till the closing date of the deal, and you're $5 to the good. I don't quite understand that. So that's one thing. The second four letters of my news fix today are TSLA, right? Which is, of course, the ticker symbol for Tesla, one of Elon Musk's other companies, which today is down, waiting for my browser to load here. It's down 11.1%, right? $886 a share off $111. And here's why. Because Musk is going to have to sell, or has given as guarantee against his loans, a bazoodleful of Tesla shares. Okay? So you kind of can't do one of these deals, Elon Musk, without the other one. And so if you're a Tesla shareholder, you're like, oh, man, Elon's going to unload a bunch of shares. I might as well get out now. And look, 11% down on the day, and we're not even, you know, at lunchtime yet. Well, we're at lunchtime in New York. But you know what I mean? It's it's a very dynamic environment, shall we say. So I need an answer to the Twitter trading $5 below the offer price. And then, obviously, we all know why Tesla's going down. And it just caught my eye today. Caught my eye.
But those Tesla folks aren't just moving their money into Twitter, it looks
like. No, they're not. That's right. So there you go. So that is my news. That is Amy's news. And on to the mailbag we go.
Yeah. Hi, Kai and Kimberly.
This is Godfrey from San Francisco.
Jesse from Charleston, South Carolina.
And I have a follow-up question.
It has me thinking and feeling a lot of things.
Is that a new news thing? Or have I just not been paying attention?
You know, it was here when I was here last.
Bridget's going to yell at me. All right. Anyway, first of all, a voice message about taxes. Here we go.
Hi, Kai and Amy. This is Erin calling from Middleton, Wisconsin. And in response to your inquiry about tax refunds from last year, we just got our tax refund this past week. And the only reason we got our refund is because when we went to file our taxes, our accountant asked us if we had received our refund from last year, and in going through all of our banking records, found no record of it.
Wow.
So after filing some paperwork and doing a little bit of inquiry, we managed to get our tax refund just before we submitted our taxes for this year. Thanks for making me part.
So two things. One, that's actually three things. Number one, that's ridiculous. Number two, that's what Congress wants to happen, because clearly they have decided that people getting their tax refunds and processing the tax returns to get the money to run the government is not important enough, because they underfund the Internal Revenue Service. And number three, as I said, Bridget yelled at me. Clearly, I haven't been paying attention to the mailbags thing because that is not a new one. All right. Anyway, that's it.
And we got this follow-up from a conversation that Sabri and I had on Friday about Taco Bell.
Hello, Make Me Smart folks. This is Brirak calling from Perrysburg, Ohio. I wanted to add to Amy's and Sabri's discussion on Taco Bell. I'm a vegetarian myself, and I love Taco Bell. Amy, I'm right there with you. I sub beans for every item on the Taco Bell menu, and the Mexican pizza is great. You should try it. Thank you.
All right.
There you go.
So, Kai, you were off, but I confessed during our game show.
Yes.
Which one were we doing? Half empty, half full, that I am a Taco Bell fan. A formerly closeted Taco Bell fan.
Yeah, right. That's the thing about this podcast. You reveal pieces of yourself that you're like, oh, wait, I didn't really mean to say anything about that.
Yeah. But you know what? I'm proud of it. I am who I am. Burak, thank you so much for sharing that. I appreciate it.
Awesome. All right. Last thing before we go, as we always do, this week's answer to the Make Me Smart question, which is, once again, what is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? Here it is.
Hi, this is April, and I live in San Diego, California. Something that I thought I knew but later found out I was wrong about was that Brontosaurus is actually a valid name for the long-necked dinosaur. I was reading a dinosaur comic book with my son, and it talked about how this archaeologist identified the Apatosaurus first, but it was a baby virgin skeleton. And then later he found an adult Brontosaurus, and he named it Brontosaurus, but they were actually the same dinosaur. But because Apatosaurus had been found first, that is the official name. But Brontosaurus is actually acceptable. And I just thought that was interesting.
I think that is a good thing to know. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I feel so redeemed because I grew up with the Brontosaurus.
Absolutely,
and then when it
too.
Came time to read my own kids' books about dinosaurs, I was like, what happened to the Brontosaurus?
Exactly.
So thank you for sharing that, April.
That's a good one. It's a good one.
Yeah. All right. Well, keep sending us your answers. I love these via voice memo to our email at makemesmart@marketplace.org, or you can leave us a message at 508-827-6278, also known as 508-UB-SMART.
Make Me Smart is directed and produced by Marissa Cabrera. Our team includes producer Marquette Green and Ellen Rolfes. She writes our newsletters. Our intern is Tiffany Bowie.
Today's program was engineered by Charlton Thorpe with mixing by Mingxin Qigong. Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez composed our theme music. Senior producer is Bridget Bodner. Donna Tam is the director of On Demand and Marketplace's vice president, and general manager is Neil Scarborough.
There you have it. Tuesday in the books. Tuesday in the books.
Not a bad Tuesday.
Not a bad Tuesday at all. Well, so far. I mean, it's early out here.
Yeah, right.
Sorry, just saying.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.